on peace. And we are really fortunate to have a very interesting collection of individuals to discuss this, to launch a discussion of this. So what I'm going to do is just introduce each of them, and then I've asked them each to speak for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then we can open it up to discussion. Perhaps let them at the end also make some reflections. So immediately on my right is Professor Nigel Bicker, who's probably known to many of you, the Regius Professor of Moral and Pastoral Theology here in Oxford, based at Christ Church College. Previously at Leeds, the Chair of Theology, and at Trinity College Dublin, who I've had the chance to interact with a couple of times on the subject of war and peace, but who also, of course, works more broadly on the contribution of religion to liberal democracies, theories of natural law, and the theology and ethics of national identity and loyalty and forgiveness. I won't go into everyone's individual publications, of which there are many, but of course he's written widely on all of these topics. Then we are lucky to have Tony Cody, who's visiting Oxford for a six-month period, who again may be known to many of you, a very well-known Australian philosopher who writes on epistemology, political violence, political ethics. He has also been, in addition to writing on violence, working on political philosophy more broadly. And he was the founder of the Centre for Philosophy and Public Issues at the University of Melbourne, really the first centre in Australia to become concerned with those issues. And it later became absorbed into CAPI, which some of you will know about. Rama Mani, thirdly, who is a research fellow, a visiting research fellow, both with ELAC and the Centre for International Studies, who's worked for a number of years on peace, justice, and human security, both as an analyst and scholar, but also as a practitioner. She's been the executive director of the International Center for Ethnic Studies in Colombo, as well as senior advisor to the Center for Humanitarian Dialogue in Geneva, where she now lives. She's worked with Oxfam in Africa. She also worked, interestingly, I didn't know this, on the Commission for Global Governance, and managed the launch of their report, which many of you will remember, Our Global Neighborhood. And she's recently been working quite a lot on the principle of the responsibility to protect from a variety of perspectives, and non-Western perspectives in particular. And she worked with Tom Weiss on a publication which we launched here last year. So that is our panel. As I say, a very illustrious one and a good one for discussing the issues today. So I'm going to let Nigel begin, and then we'll just go in turn before we open it up to discussion. Nigel.
Thank you very much. It seems to me that a lot of public discussion of the role of religion in relation to peace and war is simplistic. And sometimes that simplistic discussion even takes place within the walls of universities. So I'm going to begin by complicating matters. First of all, I want to complicate peace. Peace can mean basically or tolerably just peace. It can mean a peace which establishes the conditions for social and individual flourishing, and where conflict is managed politically. That's optimal peace. Or peace can mean simply the absence of war. Or it can mean not the absence of war, but our not fighting it. So in that last sense, in the sense of peace, meaning we're at peace, France and the UN remained at peace in 1994, which left the Hutu at peace in Rwanda to slaughter 800,000 Tutsi. In other words, what was peace for us, or the likes of us, wasn't peace for the Tutsi. Likewise, Europe and NATO remained at peace in 1995, which left the Bosnian Serbs, or some of them, at peace to slaughter 7,000 Bosnian Muslims at Srebrenica. Peace for us didn't mean peace for them. So, first point is, peace is complicated. And when we talk about peace, we need to be discriminate and clear about what we're talking about. Some peace is good, unequivocally. Just peace where everyone flourishes and conflicts are resolved politically is good, unequivocally. Other kinds of peace may be more morally ambiguous. So if peace is complicated, if you agree with me that peace is complicated, then so is war. Now, no sane person would dispute that war causes terrible evils. And by evils, I mean non-moral evils in the sense of damage or destruction. It kills people, it maims people, it destroys infrastructure. That's evil. Whether it's right or wrong, we get to decide, but it's certainly evil. Some people believe that war causes such evils that it can never be right to wage it. Those people we would call pacifists. Pacifists believe that war is always and everywhere wrong, and either that there are other sufficiently effective ways of dealing with, for example, machete-wielding Hutu mobs and ruthless Bosnian Serbs, or they believe that there aren't effective alternatives, but that going to war would still only make things worse. But either way, pacifists reckon that going to war not only causes evils, but is always in the way wrong. However, if you're not a pacifist, and I'm not, then going to war, notwithstanding the evils it causes, might be morally right. It might be morally justified, depending upon the circumstances, and depending, of course, on what criteria of justification you use. So, second complication is that war is not simply evil in the moral sense of wrong, unless you're a pacifist. Last among my complications is religion, so I'm covering all three terms in our title, just to make sure everything's properly complicated. Any student of religion knows that one of the most basic problems in the field of religious studies is how to define and identify religion. What is it? For example, is Buddhism, which is atheist, a religion? Buddhists don't believe in a divine being. It is effectively atheist. Is it a religion? And if so, why? Or is Marxism, with its biblical faith in the assuredly upward, if not straightforward, march of history toward the communist social utopia, is that religious? Is Marxism religious? So, how we define what a religion is problematic. And even where we identify two phenomena that fall directly into the category of religion, how much does that allow us to presume that these two phenomena have significant things in common? For example, what exactly has a blood-soaked Aztec priest got to do with a mild-mannered Oxford Quaker? They're both religious. So do they have anything interesting in common? So the very concept of religion is difficult and elusive. What's more, any long-standing religious tradition, especially if it's taken root in a variety of parts of the world, is going to be internally plural. So, for example, Christianity embraces, on the one hand, the anti-militarism of the first three centuries AD, the clerical and monastic eschewal of violence, and the pacifism of the Mennonites and the Quakers. That's all on the one hand. On the other hand, Christianity also embraces the just war tradition that runs from Augustine in the early 5th century through Aquinas and Grotius and right up to the present day. Both are Christian. Or both sides are Christian. And finally, any long-standing religious tradition that has had the opportunity to shape public policy is likely to have had to have a mixed historical record. So on the one hand, for example, Christianity's record includes, of course, the Crusades and the Inquisition and the so-called religious wars of the 16th and 17th century. But then, on the other hand, there's also the tradition of just war thinking, which intends to limit and moderate the use of violent force. And in that tradition is, for example, the courageous stand against the conquistadors' war on the Amerindians in the 16th century, taken by the likes of Bartolomeo de las Casas and Francisco de Vitoria. Vitoria argued out of the just war tradition that the conquistadors' justification for waging war on the Amerindians, namely that they would benefit from the imposition of the Christian gospel. Vitoria said, according to just war principles, that is unjust. So, all three terms of our discussion, religion, war, and peace, are complicated, and intelligent discussion of them will not admit of very much generalization. In the brief rest of what I have to say, I'm going to focus on the Christian tradition of just war thinking, whose first major proponent was Augustine of Hippo in North Africa in the early 5th century AD. Now, I mean, there's a whole industry working on just war doctrine, and I'm going to limit myself to making about 3 minutes worth of remarks before I finish. But it'll get us going. So the first thing to say is that the theory of just war was born during the period when, having spent the first three centuries of their existence on the social and political margins of the Roman Empire, and often at the sharp end of it, literally the sharp end, Christians in the 4th century AD, for the first time, had the opportunity to hold positions of political responsibility. And that included responsibility for maintaining law and order. So, in the early 400s, Christian tribunes, such as Marcellinus and Boniface, who had responsibility for keeping the peace, by means of force, if need be, wrote to Augustine, who was then Bishop of Hippo in North Africa, to ask how their political responsibilities were compatible with their Christian profession. And some of the earliest expressions of just war theory emerge in Augustine's pastoral response to them. That's where it started, in Christian tradition. Here are a few highlights of what the just war thinking consists of. First of all, the paradigm of a just war is not self-defense. Indeed, Augustine regarded self-defense as morally suspect. The paradigm of a just war is intervention, to rescue the innocent from unjust aggression. So what that means, of course, is that the ethic of Christian just war thinking contradicts what has become international law and the dominant secular philosophical conception of just war. The paradigm is intervention, not self-defense. Second point, just war therefore also has the general form of punishment. And this is highly controversial. We need to be careful here what we mean by punishment, which nowadays is often conflated with retribution, which itself is often conflated with vengeance. Both conflations are mistakes. Just war has a basically punitive form in the sense that it is a negative or hostile response to the perpetrator of an unjust act. A negative or hostile response to the perpetrator of an unjust act. A just war, therefore, can't be basically about imperial expansion. It can't be basically about spreading the gospel to the Indians of the Caribbean. Nor can it be basically about compelling the Chinese to open up their markets to the sale of Indian opium. It can only be about responding to an act of grave injustice. The basic form of just war is punitive. That tells us nothing, nothing, about what punishment is for, but what its ends are, what its goals are. What should these be? Certainly, the goals of punishment should be to halt the perpetration of injustice, to persuade the perpetrator not to resume it, and to deter others from assuming it. In other words, defensive and deterrent. Those are the purposes. What the goal of punishment should not be is the annihilation of the perpetrator. Christian punishment may not be vengeful. And since there are international courts available, just war should not be retributive in the narrow sense of assessing the culpability of the main perpetrators of injustice and apportioning proportionate punishment to them. War is too blunt and indiscriminate an instrument for that. But it is punitive in defensive and in deterrent senses. Finally, my final point, just war from a Christian point of view is war that is justified, all things considered. It is not war that is just in the sense of morally pure or holy. A just war is not a crusade. It is not a holy war. It is only ever waged by one set of sinners against others, not simply by the righteous against the simply unrighteous. It is absolutely not Manichaean. It does not distinguish sharply between the children of light on the one hand and the children of darkness on the other. And it is important to remember that Manichaeism was a Christian heresy, which Augustine repudiated. He was a Manichaean for a while, so he knew what he was talking about. He knew what he was repudiating. And which the Christian Church ever since has contradicted. We human beings are often bound up in each other's wrongdoing. To some extent, for example, the victors of 1918 gave rise, through the Treaty of Versailles, to the rise of Nazism. But that isn't to say that France and Britain were wrong to go to war in punitive response to Hitler's invasion of Poland in 1939. We went to war then with an appropriately heavy heart, and rightly so. So no simple righteous against the unrighteous. I'll stop there.
Thank you so much. Tony, let me turn it over to you.
Yeah, I've got a thing to read out, so I might stand up on the podium.
Sure, yeah, absolutely, if you'd like to.
Give me a more dominating perspective.
And I should say we need to be a bit kinder, Tony, because he's got a bit of a cold. So
I think you'll manage to detect that as I go on. It may affect my timing. I've got this down to 13 minutes, I think. Every era has assumptions that pass to the merest common sense and upon which social and political outlooks and programs often depend. Until recently, for instance, the supposed incapacity of women for the sort of reasoning required for political participation was one such assumption. The premises of the pervasive managerialism that has infected so many institutions and democratic societies, including, sad to say, our universities, provide another example. The apparent obviousness and widespread instinctive acceptance of such assumptions make them hard to expose to critical evaluation or to have such evaluation taken seriously. In our own time, and for some time earlier, another such assumption has been that which assigns to religion and religious difference an inherent tendency to violence. It seems to me that this assumption is wrong, or at least sufficiently wrong-headed, to distort our understanding of both religion and the resort to violence, such as warfare. In this short talk, I won't directly discuss religion and peace, but a critique of the assumption about the tendency to violence should remove some obstacles to that discussion. Recently, the assumption and its implications have started to come under stringent scrutiny, most radically in Bill Kavanaugh's writings, culminating in his book, The Myth of Religious Violence. Kavanaugh's thesis, to summarise his thought all too simplistically, involves two separable but supporting arguments, to the effect that claims about the inherent tendency of religions to promote violence are too opaque to be taken seriously. One argument is that the sharp separation of religion from other areas of human life is peculiarly modern and a mostly Western phenomenon. Consequently, much of the evidence for the violent propensities of religion is drawn from contexts in which motivations for violence are multifaceted, and what would now be called religion merely one integrated element in a motive set. This integration continues today in societies that have not embraced secularity in the way that most European societies have. The second argument is that the repeated failures by theorists to provide a satisfactory definition of religion shows that the idea, which has already been mentioned by Nigel, shows that the idea of religion is too muddled, even incoherent, to support the claims about religion's tendency to promote violence. Kavanagh does not, of course, deny that there are particular faiths, such as Christianity and Islam, but he thinks that the construct religion is a sort of vague portmanteau into which all sorts of old-fashioned things are put by the modern secular mind. The advantage for that secular mind, according to him, is to facilitate a sharp contrast between its own benign propensities and the potential dark savagery of those who don't conform to its prescriptions. I think Kavanagh's critique is very valuable, but some of his claims about how difficult it is in past cultures to find a phenomenon like what we call today religion, and how distinctive is our current separation of religion from other aspects of life, are disputable. Although pre-modern societies did not place such a wide gulf between the domains of religion and those of politics and other secular activities, there is plenty of evidence that they distinguished between them. Indeed, Christ's dictum, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and God the things that are God's," already contains such a distinction. Martin Riesebrock's fascinating new book, The Promise of Salvation, A Theory of Religion, provides plenty of counterexamples as well. Moreover, it's plausible that a broad, though no doubt fuzzy-edged definition or general account of religion can be serviceable, though it will no doubt contain some element of stipulation. Riesebrock provides an interesting such account, predominantly in terms of characteristic action rather than belief. He concentrates on practices that, quote, aim at establishing contact with superhuman powers with the purpose of averting or mitigating misfortune and securing salvation. Well, whatever we think of that, or of Kavanagh's analytic rejection of the religion concept, the integration argument that Kavanagh mounts is detachable from his more sweeping claim and initially more plausible. To take the terrorist activities of contemporary Islamic fundamentalists as simply manifestations of religion, for instance, is to ignore the way that their religious commitments complement and intersect with political outlooks and grievances that would make perfect sense to non-religious people, even though they seldom bother to examine such motivations, convinced as they are that the cause of the violence is wholly religious. But as Robert Papers argued, an examination of the motives and background of suicide bombers from 1980 to 2003, a total of 315 attacks, excluding those commissioned by states, an examination of that shows that religion is seldom what he calls a significant factor in these motivations. Papers recently upgraded his database and has now examined over 2,000 suicide bombing cases with similar conclusions. He sums up his conclusions as, "Religion is rarely the root cause, though it's often used as a tool by terrorist organisations in recruiting and in other efforts in service of the broader strategic objective." Inevitably, Pape's work and methodology have come under criticism, especially regarding his strong claims about the unique role of foreign intervention and occupation in provoking terrorist attacks. Nonetheless, his basic claims about the relatively slight or secondary nature of religious motivation in most suicide bombings compared to perfectly mundane, earthly ones is, I think, accurate enough to be instructive for my purposes. So I would say there are three things that the focus on religion's supposed special and inherent tendency towards violence tends to obscure. One, that there are many dreadful outbreaks of unjustified violence, the causal or motivational origins of which have nothing to do with religion. Pol Pot, Mao and Stalin in our own era are responsible for staggering massacres that cannot be attributed to their authors' religious inclinations or that of their followers. Nor, in spite of Richard Dawkins' claims to the contrary, is it credible that Hitler's murderous campaigns had a religious motivation. Even in less dramatic conflicts than these, factors like nationalism, border disputes, great power ambitions, imperialism and racism have been significant factors in outbreaks of violence, including wars, often with little or no input from religion. Secondly, that the simple credo of religion causes violence, like Christopher Hitchens' ludicrous subtitle to his book, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything, ignores too many distinctions. There are and have been all sorts of religions with a great many different practices, ethical commitments and changes over the course of their histories. It may well be that some religions or versions of the same religion are prone to spur their adherence towards violence, where other religions or other versions of the same religion have no such tendency. Even if it could be shown that versions of Islam, such as Osama bin Laden's, had a commitment to unjustified violence, this would have no relevance, for instance, to the Sufi version of Islam, nor to the Quaker version of Christianity. Three, that the focus on religion as a major cause of wars, terrorism, and other forms of political violence obscures many of the more mundane, specific causes of violent conflict that political leaders and the rest of us often find inconvenient to acknowledge. This is true even when there are issues of religion invoked by the leaders of the campaigns of violence. Even Osama bin Laden's various diatribes referring to holy duties and caliphates contain numerous claims about straightforward political grievances, such as Israel's occupation of Palestine, Palestinian land, and military policing and political persecution, as he saw it, of Palestinian people, claims about past and present Western support for Middle Eastern dictatorships and Western exploitation of Middle Eastern assets, the United States' historic deployment of troops throughout Arab lands, and of course, more recently, the US-led invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan. A fascinating example of the complexity I've been trying to point out is Peter Wilson's new book, A History of the 30 Years' War, which argues that this war, so often invoked as the archetypical religious war, the duration of which was caused by religious fanaticism, in the common understanding, was, as Wilson says, quote, not primarily a religious war at all. There were, of course, religious elements, since it could hardly have been otherwise in 17th century Europe, where Christian faith was an aspect of life integrated to varying degrees with other central aspects. But most contemporary observers, he says, quote, spoke of imperial, Bavarian, Swedish, or Bohemian troops, not Catholic or Protestant, unquote. The war indeed began with a somewhat religious episode, the famous defenestration of Prague, in which Protestant gang threw three Catholic imperial officials out the window. They fell from the height, appealing to the Virgin Mary, and landed in a dump heap, almost entirely unharmed. No doubt all the atheists will think that this had nothing to do with their rescue, but I'm rather impressed. beginning with that episode, the ferocity and duration of the war was not due, argues Wilson, to religious fanaticism, but dynastic ambition and political fissure. As one reviewer of the book summarises the argument, quote, the empire's hundreds of small territories were cash poor. To fight, they assumed impossible debts, adulterated their coinages, and triggered a ruinous inflation. Unpaid armies could be neither supplied nor disbanded. They thus remained in the field, nourished on plunder. A crucial point that underlies these three considerations is that a primary factor in outbreaks of violence is attachment to identity and alarm at perceived threats to it. Religion certainly provides one focus for this attachment to alarm, but so do a great range of other things. Identity is closely related to power, self-respect, and perceived cultural positioning, so that religion will often be appropriated to bolster or create culturally significant identities by those who have or want power. I think probably the relation between the sexes is in point. The fashioning of a male identity was often dominant over roles against females has been a feature of history to which religion has contributed, but it seems to me to be even deeper sociologically than any religious influence. I was going to finish with a brief word about peace, but
go ahead.
It's very brief and it's probably not very helpful, but still. I just felt I would have covered the ground. I've said very little about religion and peace, so I'll conclude with a brief comment. Peace is a complex concept. We've already heard about that. with many interpretations and conceptions built around it over the ages. I've dealt with some of these complexities in my book Morality and Political Violence, available at all good bookshops for a very reasonable price. I would conjecture without being... That's what I had to get in. I would conjecture without being an expert on comparative religion that there are very few religions that don't make the value of peace a significant part of their doctrines. Augustine, for instance, places it at the heart of his Christocentric ethical system along with love. It's true that, as with many other Christians and non-Christians, he thought it compatible with the idea of just war in extremis, though other Christians have thought it required pacifism. Certainly, there's room for peacemakers and activists to build upon these doctrines of peace within many religions. And that's where I ran out of both my time and the allotted time.
Thanks very much, Tony. That's great. Rama, you're going to stand as well, or are you going to sit? Whichever you'd like.
I'll stand so I can see everyone. Should I stand here or there? Maybe I'll stand there so I have something to put my papers on. Lovely. Thanks to ELAC for somehow managing always to pull together occasions like this so we can get into a real debate, I wouldn't say argument, and I'm very happy I come third. And it's very tempting to jump right into the debate with all of what you've put on the table. I'll start with the points I wanted to make because it fits in very well where Tony left off, where I would agree that we need to move away from the simplifications, the simple causality that is drawn all too often since especially the end of the Cold War between religion and war, the simplicity around peace and war and their moral goodness or badness, and whether or not religions are simplistically drawn towards violence. What I would say is, while deferring to the fact that religions have managed, in many of religious leaders, religious movements, religious initiatives, have managed to make extraordinary, inspiring contributions to peace in many different ways, we won't go into that right now, from kind of individual examples like Sant'Egidio to, maybe by the time I started speaking, 1 of 7 or so, in Mozambique, or to movements like peace movements, to religious leaders of different faiths in the Great Lakes region. On the whole, I would be still inclined to argue that religions remain today a greater malady, a greater cause of violence than a cause of peace. And the problem I feel is that we as academics have jumped onto the bandwagon of looking primarily at extremism and extreme religious fundamentalism as the cause of such violence. That deflects attention, as you very rightly pointed out, from what I think is much more serious, which is right under our feet. It was found in 2000 in a Millennium Survey that was conducted by Gallup that, contrary to our belief in secularism, actually something close to 90% of the world's population claims to be faithful. Possibly a maximum of about 14% would define themselves as atheists. Everyone else is agnostic plus. The vast majority still remain Christian and Muslim, but Buddhists, Hindus are still very, very major. And I would say that what we really need to be looking at is the mainstream beliefs and unexamined practices of the mainstream believers. So it's not those few extremists at the fringes of the Islamic and other, you know, cultish movements who suddenly have explosions of violence here and there, including terrorist violence, but actually mainstream beliefs and practices, because these are accepted, these are not examined, and they are the cause for, if not both, current violence and potential violence. Let me highlight some of the reasons why I believe religions have failed in these respects to be peace builders and rather have been come towards violence, and possibly conclude by saying what could change or how could this be changed. What are these common beliefs and practices? Many religions, we'll come back hopefully in the discussion to discuss what are religions. I'm talking about the principle, the major. There's something like 2,500 religions out there. No, 12,000. But the five major ones have the majority of people adhering to them. So the major religions. The first one is the belief in singularity. My religion is the best, which we can see how easily it has in the past and continues to, at present, lead to divisions within society, domination within society, which leads to the second problem, which is many of these religions have proselytizing tendencies. Even religions which were originally not proselytizing, like Buddhism, have become major proselytizers. many reasons why proselytizing is going on across the world. We now know the majority of Christians and Hindus are not in their countries of, or regions of origin, but in Asia, Africa, Latin America, etc. Why is this a problem? The kinds of incentives, including financial incentives given for proselytization, leading to a huge cleavage in haves and have-nots within these societies, a change in religious demographics within one generation, and the consequences of that, the fact that we know that recent converts are much more prone to extreme behavior in their religious zeal. So all the reasons why proselytism is an ongoing cause of concern practiced by religions. The third one is anthropocentrism, the belief central in Abrahamic religions, but conveniently picked up by others, that man is the apex of creation and that all of creation, all of nature is at his, I say his deliberately, disposal to use and get rid of, which has led throughout history and right now, I mean, we are in the center of a kind of rapacity that we simply, of exploiting nature and exploiting lesser beings, believing that we are supreme. Fourth, male authority, which Tony already referred to, the exclusion of women from positions of authority, and the extraordinary violence which religion has condoned or sometimes exhorted against women within the community, which is directly related to the kind of violence we have seen in the Democratic Republic of Congo, in all these conflicts against women outside the community. If religion is so permissive about violence within to women within your own family, well, where are the bounds when it's outside? Fifth, again referred to by my colleagues, the close connection, nexus between religion and power. Bowing very often not to the dictates of the founding fathers or mothers, of religion being at the service of justice in this world as in the universe, but rather consorting with power to the negligence of issues of injustice. And then this issue which is completely overlooked, the attention given to form over substance, the predominance of ritualism and maintaining the institutions, often not simply ignoring but actually contradicting the fundamental values underlying that religion, the founding universal principles of that religion. The imperviousness to change, and if we go back and look at how all major religions had built into them very, very deep practices of debate, critical inquiry, discussion. No, the Socratic debate was not limited to Socrates. It was at the core of even Judaism, Hinduism, Christianity, Islam was all about that, which has disappeared, and now there's a rigid adherence to the rituals, the practices, but not actually examining the fundamental truths and debating them, which has meant that all of this has led to religions becoming the opposite of what they were meant to be and defined as being, which is re ligare, which ought to have been a triple linkage, relinking human beings to ourselves through the internal debate, to each other within society and our societal dealings with each other, and to us in the universe and how we deal with this creation of which we are a part. And I would say these are the reasons why these unexamined beliefs and practices, which most of us are somehow involved with one way or another, or most religions and religious believers are involved with, these are the causes for violence, deserving as much attention now as the extremist fundamentalist actions that we tend to study much more. What could be the way out? A few simple steps. One would be for all religions, religious institutions, religious believers, and individuals to systematically prioritize justice over power, to return to the kind of commitment that one finds in traditions like the liberation theology of Latin America, which spread across the global south. The second would be to integrate everything that has been excluded, divided, marginalized, of course, starting with women, but all of the other kinds of discrimination, often very violent, that goes on and is justified by religion. I'm thinking of gays, I'm thinking of minorities, of lower castes in my own country of origin, of undertaking critical inquiry, bringing that back into the core of religious practice, not rote learning, not practice of rituals, but critical inquiry, bringing together religion, bringing together the rationality with faith. moving off the high pedestal of believing that monotheism is somehow the pinnacle of human development and evolution, and bowing, deferring to the wisdom of so-called cosmotheandric religions at this age of ecological devastation, recognizing what they were saying of our place very humbly as a small part of an interdependent universe, which we are rapidly destroying. So bringing in this value of cosmotheandry and turning towards self-examination, contemplation, and conscious evolution rather than the triumphalism that still tends to go with religions. I end off, as I can't help it, with two wonderful women and their quotes. Saint Teresa of Avila, such a champion for introspection in the world gone crazy in Spain with the Inquisition, who said, "Why this great war between the countries inside of us? What are all these insane borders we protect? What are all these different names for the same church of love we kneel in together? For it is true, together we live, and only at that shrine where all are welcome will God sing loud enough to be heard." And already centuries before her, her sister, the Sufi in Basra, Rabia, the Sufi slave turned saint, said, "In my heart, there is a temple, a church, a synagogue, what is left, a mosque where I kneel." Prayer should bring us to an altar where no walls and no names exist. And if we could return to that, religions, all religions, the believers and the non-believers and the agnostic, could become actually champions of building peace in our societies. Thank you, and I hope that leads us into a lively discussion.
Thanks so much. Great, well, everybody's stuck fairly well to time. Shall I open up to questions, comments?